called first. The woman explained that she was about to vacate the apartment, to which I replied, I am black. And if you have feelings about allowing your apartment to be rented by someone of that race, tell me now. She laughed. You don't have to worry, she said. My husband is black. That's how I ended up as the lone black person in an all-white building, a few streets away from a love story. The Blacks, the critically acclaimed play written by French dramatist Jean Genet, became the defining role of my blossoming career. I am not one to feel as if I have arrived, for even at age 96, I am still arriving. But being cast in that show was the closest I've come to experiencing that delight. From the pen of a provocateur flowed a masterpiece of racial reckoning, an incendiary visual display meant to cajole. The spectacle unfolded nightly down at St. Mark's Playhouse in the Village and marked the beginning of avant-garde theater. For Genet, The Blacks was a commentary on prejudice, a play within a play, urging white audiences to gaze upon themselves. For me and a cadre of other rising black actors, it was also sustained exposure and steady earnings. The show became the longest-running off-Broadway non-musical of the 1960s, debuting in May 1961 and not lowering its curtain until September 1964. I played Stephanie Virtue Diop, an impish streetwalker and a steadily paid one, thank you very much. The show lasted so long that I came and went over its three-year, 1,408-show run, squeezing in other work where I could. The same was true for much of the cast. Dignitaries filed through the audience regularly, and in 1962, Dr. King and his wife Coretta took their seats in the audience. I wasn't performing on that evening, but his attendance demonstrated the show's importance. It was more than a play. It was a landmark cultural moment, an indictment of white supremacy, and a theatrical pivot point. Just about every young actor of note was at some point connected with the Blacks. The grand ensemble included James Earl Jones, Roscoe Lee Brown, Lou Gossett Jr., Billy Dee Williams, Charles Gordone, and Maya Angelou. The circle of black actors was then fairly small, so I knew several of my castmates. Others, like James Earl Jones, I met for the first time. He was painfully shy in those years, reticent enough to make my own bashfulness seem like extroversion. He kept to himself backstage, but boy, once that curtain rose, he spoke plenty. Maya, who played the queen, both in The Blacks and in real life, intimidated me at first. At 6 feet, she towered over me, and she had the confidence and booming voice to match her stature. She walked around like she owned the world, whereas I always sat in a corner and waited for Jean Frankel, the director, to shout, "Come on stage," before I moved a hair. At the read-through for the show, I first spotted Maya alongside Abby Lincoln, the actress and jazz vocalist, who was also in the cast. Maya and Abby were quite close then, before they later had a falling out. Recalling it brings me to tears, because they had been such good friends. Maya was larger than life, a force of nature, and every other cliché inadequate for capturing her essence. Over the years, we'd often debate about when we met, with me insisting it was during The Blacks. "No, I met you 2 years before that," she'd claim, but she could never recall where. "You are the one friend I've known the longest." I'd deny her recollection, and back and forth we'd go. It didn't matter to me when we met, because we became so close. Maya was many things to many people, but perhaps one of her greatest roles was that of a hostess. That woman's home, then at Park West Village near 100th Street and Columbus, was always full. She seemed to know everybody, from Duke Ellington to James Baldwin, as well as the scores of artists she'd connected with through the Harlem Writers Guild, part of the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s. Rosa Guy, the Guild's co-founder, along with John Oliver Killens, Audre Lorde, Sarah E. Wright, Douglas Turner Ward, on and on. For Maya to pull out her finest cutlery and baccarat crystal, there needn't be a holiday or special occasion, other than the blessing of still breathing. She was always welcoming people, throwing pots onto the stove, lending her generous spirit and constant laughter to her Southern home-cooked recipes, just like Miles did. I was precisely the opposite. Once I retreated into my apartment after a show, my home became my haven. "I don't know how you have any friends," my mother would often say. "You never have anyone over." I didn't need to. I did plenty of socializing at Maya's place. My friend, Roxy Roker, who, in the Blacks, eventually replaced Maya as the Queen before going on years later to play Helen in the TV sitcom The Jeffersons, was often over at Maya's. Roxy and I clicked from the first hello. She's also Caribbean. Her father was from Andros in the Bahamas, and when we'd get together, we'd yammer back and forth in a heavy West Indian dialect. It was very funny. The Blacks cast did everything together. We dined, drank, gossiped, and even traveled with one another. One summer, we were invited to perform our show at a festival in Venice, my first time in Europe. I loved Venice, but my eagerness for adventure lured me beyond. "Why don't you just stay here?" Roscoe asked me. "You can stay," I told him, "but I'm going on." I took the train to Rome and then to Munich. Lex Monsoon, who played the bishop in The Blacks, came with me. Lex hopped off in Germany, but I boarded a sleeper train on to Barcelona. I found it thrilling to be on the road by myself, wandering and wondering as I'd done in childhood, taking in the smells and sounds and rich history of each passing city, storing away the experiences in that place where I keep all my sense memories. I relished my time in Spain in particular. Having grown up in an integrated neighborhood that included Puerto Ricans, I enjoyed the warm spirit of the Latin culture. The Spaniards greeted me with open hearts. Home in New York, the crew got back to talking smack. On most nights after the show, a bunch of us would gather at Sardi's, an Italian eatery on West 44th Street in the theater district. Child, we talked about each other like dogs. If you weren't in attendance on a particular evening, boy, you can be sure you were being bad-mouthed. Everybody gathered there, even those who weren't in the show. Lonnie Elder came through a lot. So did Diana Sands, Bobby Hooks, and of course Diane and Sydney. That show not only kept us employed, it also kept us laughing. Those were some fun times. Everyone, and especially me, knew that Sydney and Diane had eyes for one another. The two of them went to France to work on the movie Paris Blues in 1961, and while they were there, they must have forgotten that they were both married. From the beginning of their relationship, I never believed Sidney would leave his wife to be with Diane. But next thing I knew, Diane was divorcing Monty so she could be with Sidney. She even bought a place and furnished it, waiting for him to come. But he never did. She set that record straight herself in her own book, "The Legs Are the Last to Go." Not long after Diane separated from Monty and was waiting on Sidney to divorce his wife as he'd said he would, I ran into Sidney near Carnegie Hall. As usual, he came over and hugged me. "Hey, sis," he said, beaming. "How are you?" "I'm good," I told him. After we'd caught up, I said, "Well, congratulations. I hear you're finally going to take the walk again. He looked down at the pavement and started kicking around a can, and in that moment I knew. Sydney wasn't ever going to marry Diane. He didn't have to say another word. His body language did his speaking. During the years to follow, Diane carried on with her life and career, earning a Tony for No Strings, an Oscar nomination for Claudine, and a Golden Globe for her lead role in Julia, the 1968 sitcom that was the first to defy black female stereotypes on television. I'm not sure whether she ever got over Sydney, but through her portrayals and an extraordinary 6 decades on the stage, the swelligant, elegant Diane Carroll surely spoke a resounding word. I had my own share of romances before I met Miles. After my brief marriage to Kenneth, I hadn't wanted much to do with men. My priorities were my daughter Joan and the stage. Still, a few relationships sprang up, some of them lasting the length of my pinky finger. I dated a disc jockey for a time, a man I met at a jazz club. That went on for only a few months. After he'd worried me half to death with too much talking, I dumped him by calling into a radio station and dedicating the Billie Holiday song to him, "You Ain't Gonna Bother Me No More." Another man, a dancer, lasted just weeks before I let him go. I don't even recall why. But any time I'd break up with someone, my mother would start asking about him. Men loved to charm her with gifts and flowers, and she gladly accepted the bounty. "Why you didn't marry so-and-so?" she'd lament. "He was such a nice man." "Look, get out of my business," I'd retort. "If he's so nice, why don't you marry him?" That was enough to close her mouth. Even when I wasn't dating, others always seemed to be speculating that I was, or else trying to get in on the action. Backstage at the Blacks, someone once cut a peeping Tom hole in the curtain covering my changing area. "Who did this?" I asked, grinning. A few of my male castmates snickered, but none of them said a word. I later found out it was Godfrey Cambridge, who admitted he'd been trying to catch a glimpse. I didn't pay him any mind, especially after I made a discovery offset. I once went to the library to do some research on Jean Genet, and there it was in black and white. The playwright and I had the same birth date, December 19th. I decided then that I, too, must be an artistic genius. Well, sir, the next day I strode backstage with my head up in the air, never looking to the left or right. I stepped into my changing area and yanked closed my holy curtain. "It doesn't matter what tricks any of you all try to pull on me," I blurted out, "because I know I am a genius." We all got a good laugh out of that one. Godfrey wasn't the only suitor trying to sneak a peek. Once I became known around town as Cicely Tyson, the promising young star, my phone never stopped ringing. I got calls from just about every black man in theater. "Can I help you?" I'd say. "This is so-and-so," I'd hear, "and I just want to welcome you to the business. How about dinner?" One man would call and then say nothing once I picked up. Another actor, one who was married, would call and try to disguise his voice. James Earl Jones, after he'd moved past his shyness and gotten to know me well, in 1962, we did Moon on a Rainbow Shawl together, once said, "All of the guys in all of the plays around town were just trying to take Cicely out." I didn't go out with any of them. I wanted to keep my stage life and my personal one separate. It was during these years that I met my closest friend, Arthur Mitchell, the acclaimed dancer. One night when I was leaving the Blacks, walking over to the Hotel Albert, I heard someone behind me say, "Miss Tyson." I turned around to see him, tall and beaming. "My name is Arthur Mitchell," he said. I know who you are, I said, chuckling. A few years earlier, in 1955, Arthur had already cemented his place in history as the first African-American dancer with the New York City Ballet. Soon after, he went on to become the principal dancer. He'd just seen The Blacks that evening, and he told me how much he'd enjoyed the play. That topic led to another, and Lord knows how long we stood on that corner and talked. Finally, I told him, I've got to go. Okay, he said, turning to leave, but we're going to work together someday. He's crazy, I thought to myself. I'm an actress. He's a dancer. How in the world are we ever going to work together? Time would prove me to be the crazy one. We ran into each other again, this time on the Upper West Side. He too had an apartment there, a few blocks away from mine. He walked me from the number one train at 79th Street to my front door. Thus began a ritual. When I'd returned from the Blacks, Arthur would meet me at the train, escort me to my place, and then walk to his own. And every single night, he'd stop by a candy store and buy himself a pint of vanilla ice cream. Once home, he'd call me, as if years had passed since we'd last connected, and we'd talk as he scooped up his dessert. We'd laugh and carry on for hours, talking about everything and everyone. That conversation went on for 60 years. In those times, I did have one romance that survived longer than 5 minutes. Just as I was hobnobbing my way into the business, I crossed paths with Bert Andrews, the photographer. I still marvel at how destiny's gossamer strings pulled us together. Sometime around 1956, I was walking down 7th Street when I spotted a gentleman on the other side of the road. His eyes lit up as if he knew me, and he made his way over to my side of the avenue. With a camera around his neck and a leather bag overflowing with film, he introduced himself. "Miss Tyson, my name is Bert Andrews," he said, extending his hand. He was working for the Amsterdam News at the time, he explained. But he once had worked with the photographer Chuck Stewart, who'd photographed me for the cover of Our World. "If you ever need some more photos for your portfolio," Bert offered, "I'd be happy to take them." The whole time he spoke, I stood there staring at him and thinking, where have I seen this face before? I couldn't place him. And suddenly, as he was leaving, it came to me clear as crystal. This is the man from the wedding. Several years before, I'd attended a wedding with my family. I was seated at a table with my mother and Emily, enjoying the meal and the celebration, when a man walked into the ballroom. He was there to take photographs, and a host greeted him. I was so taken with this man. The kindness in his expression, the depth in his eyes, the gentleness of his manner, that I could not look away. That is how arresting I found his face. The two of us were never introduced that day, and moments after he arrived, he disappeared into another room to take pictures of the wedding party, I'm sure. And here he was, a decade later, as drawn to my face from across a street as I'd once been to his. Isn't that something? I told him what I'd recalled, and after a round of amazement, he handed me his card. "Give me a call when you're ready," he said. "It would be my pleasure to photograph you." Bert began shooting me, and eventually we started seeing one another. We were two young strivers, he poring over photos in his dark room in the wee hours after midnight, me making relentless rounds to build my modeling career. It was in that commonality of dreams, as well as the warmth I first recognized in him, that our relationship flourished, both personally and professionally. After I'd landed the lead in Dark of the Moon, Vinette said to me, "I need a photographer." "I have one for you," I told her. Bert came to a rehearsal and met my mentor, and after looking through his portfolio, she hired him. In the years to follow, Bert became the foremost photographer of Black theater, His work featured in a book I cherish and still purchase by the dozens, In the Shadow of the Great White Way, Images from the Black Theater. The 1950s and 1960s were a momentous era in Black theater, and through his wide lens and open heart, he captured and memorialized all of it. Bert and I dated for a few years, and even once life moved us on, we remained good friends. "Whatever happened to Burke?" my mother would, of course, ask, mispronouncing his name. "He was such a nice man." I'd just smile and shake my head. I saw Bert frequently around the business, and while I was in the Blacks, he once came by to show me some photographs he'd taken. During the show's run, I'd sometimes stay at the Hotel Albert down on 10th Street and within walking distance of St. Mark's Playhouse. Bert met me there, and as we looked through his shots, he noticed a review I'd just clipped out of the New York Times. The piece was about Pauline Marshall, the renowned Barbados-born writer. In 1959, she'd penned her first book, Brown Girl Brownstones, a novel about a Trinidadian immigrant family eking out an existence in 1940s Brooklyn, while confronting the dual scourges of racism and poverty. "Someday, they are going to do a movie of this book," I told Bert, "and I am going to play the lead character." "Oh, do you know Polly?" he asked. "No," I said, "but I am going to know her." A smile spread over his face. "We did our first job together," he told me. "She is a writer and me as a photographer. I'll call her up and arrange for you to meet her." On the appointed day, Bert and I, along with Polly and her husband, gathered at the couple's home. Over dinner, Polly and Bert, who hadn't seen each other in the longest time, caught up about everything under the sun, but no mention of the book. When it came time to leave, Polly leaned in to talk with me. "You know," she said, "this book that I've written, CBS is talking about turning it into a television movie, but I don't have any confidence it will happen." She then handed me a copy of the book. "Read it, and when I return from Barbados in a few weeks, I'll let you know if anything comes of it." I inhaled the book in one sitting. Polly didn't just write a novel teeming with authenticity of the immigrant experience. We know now, in hindsight, that her writings became what scholars have called a critical bridge between early Black female writers like Zora Neale Hurston and later ones such as Toni Morrison. She also did what so little art then and now manages to do: shine a light on the interior world of Black women, and in so doing, render us fully human. The novel features two characters, 16-year-old Selena Boyce and her sister Ina, 9. As I read, my skin tingled, as it does when I absolutely know I am meant to take on a project. Soon after, Polly called me. "Yes, CBS is going to do it," she told me, "and they want you to play Selena." I paused. "Well, I don't want to play the older sister," I told her. "I want to play Ina." God knows I was nowhere near age 9, and playing Ina would strain credulity for the audience. But that is the role that resonated with me. That child was in me. Still, when I showed up to meet the casting director, I read for Selena. And as I was leaving, the director said to me, "Miss Tyson, come back here. Why don't you read Ina?" When I was done, he reached over, took my script, folded it, and tucked it under my arm. "Call me after 6 o'clock this evening," is all he said. As it turns out, he'd been prepared to bring in a young girl to play Ina, but once he heard me, that plan vanished. I did call him that night, and to my astonishment, I was 35 at the time, he offered me the role of Ina. Benita Evans, then 20, played Selena. Ossie Davis played our father. The CBS Repertoire Workshop marked my first role on a TV show, and it all came about through a fortuitous reconnection with Bert. This life amazes me. Between Bert and Miles stretched a long canyon, one filled with no serious romance to speak of. The loves of my life then were Joan, who I kept at my side whenever I wasn't working, and the stage. I dated here and there, of course, but had no intention of marrying, not in the years when I was building my career. My friend Roxy went a different way. When we weren't cutting up over at Sardi's, Roxy and I would sometimes meet at the Carlisle, near 76th and Madison. During her run in the Blacks, she began dating Cy Kravitz, then a news producer at NBC. "I've got something to tell you," she said one evening when we met for dinner. She smiled. "What?" I said, leaning in. "Cy asked me to marry him," she said. My eyes widened. "Oh, really?" I said. She nodded. "Well, my guy hasn't asked me to marry him," I said with a smirk. "So you better hurry up and marry that one." I, of course, had no desire to tie the knot then, nor do I recall whom I was even seeing. Yet I was thrilled to witness the joy on my friend's countenance. Roxy and Cy indeed married in 1962 and soon moved around the corner from me on the Upper West Side. 2 years later, they welcomed their son, little Lenny. Lenny Kravitz is my beloved godson, and I'll tell you, I am so proud of that man. Years later, when Lenny was grown, I was still living on 74th Street. I heard some loud music in Riverside Park. I opened the door to the terrace and spotted a group out there carrying on. So I put on my shoes and went down to see what all the commotion was about. As I entered the park, there stood Lisa Bonet, Lenny's wife at the time, and then playing Denise Huxtable on The Cosby Show. "Miss Cicely," she said, hugging me. "What are you all doing over here in my neighborhood?" I asked her. "We're cutting Lenny's record," she told me. When I made my way back upstairs, I called Roxy. "You hear all that noise?" I said, raising the phone's receiver out on the terrace. "That's your son and daughter-in-law making all of this noise in our neighborhood." We both just fell out laughing. During my years in the Blacks, and as winds of dissent bristled through the nation, I once considered relocating to Atlanta, the cradle of the civil rights movement. My castmates, and especially Maya, who'd been quite involved with the movement and knew Dr. King well, talked me out of it. They feared for my life. My sister Emily had traveled down south several times. A girlfriend of hers was married to a minister, and he was from Georgia, I think. After visiting there, Emily would come back raving about how wonderful it was to be surrounded by Black people who had their own schools, their own churches, their own cultural events and communities. She had a ball. Visiting a loving Black family in Atlanta provided my sister with one vantage point, but driving through the small towns and byways of the South gave me a different one. During the 1950s, I took a road trip with a friend of mine, a musician by the name of Eddie. He and I drove from New York to Georgia, winding our way through Virginia, North Carolina, and Tennessee. Somewhere along the back roads of Alabama, we stopped at a small restaurant, more like a shack, to get something to eat. He parked and went around back to put in his order. I stayed in the car. Moments later, he jumped back in the car, out of breath, and gripping a brown paper bag containing his food. He shoved the key into the ignition. "What's the matter with you?" I asked him, laughing a little. "Why can't we sit here and eat?" "Shh," he said, starting the engine. "Don't laugh. We gotta get out of here." After we'd driven a distance, he exhaled, and I started in with my questions. "Why did we leave there so fast?" I asked him. He looked straight ahead at the road. "We're in the South Sicily," he said. "What does that mean?" I asked. "It means it wouldn't take them but a second to pull me out of this car and lynch me right here." I will never know what happened around back outside of that restaurant. Eddie never revealed it to me. Perhaps, while he waited for his order, someone had shot him a look that sent shivers through him. Perhaps he dared to breathe in a white person's direction. Perhaps, thinking of Emmett Till, he feared the imminence of death, his own lifeless body floating down a river. That experience piqued my first deep interest in the mistreatment of our people in this country. I began reading, taking in all I could about our history, about the assaults that tested us but could not break us. It stung me even as it flung open my eyes. America has our blood on its palms, our flesh between its teeth. When you come to understand what we have endured, when you let the barefaced savagery of it all truly penetrate, you are forever haunted by the horror. Years after my journey south, when I mentioned to Maya that I wanted to temporarily leave acting to become part of the civil rights movement, I thought I had a fairly good idea of what I'd be getting into. Maya disagreed. "You can't go down there," she insisted. "You'll end up dead." The quiver in her voice, one I'd never once heard up to then, persuaded me she was right. 12. Going natural. I never set out to start a natural hair craze. On the day I showed up at Shalimar Barbershop in Harlem, I simply wanted a haircut. What came next stunned even me. The year was 1962. I was in the Blacks by then and had also been asked to take a role in Between Yesterday and Today, the CBS Sunday morning drama. In a single live episode, I was to play an African wife, a woman who, once in the United States, wished to preserve her cultural heritage. The cast rehearsed the day before the show, and like many Black women in those times, I was then wearing my hair relaxed. This character wouldn't have worn her hair straightened, I kept thinking, as we ran through the script. So adamant was this woman about embracing her native culture, there was no way she would have chemically processed hair. It didn't feel right to me. So I took myself up to Shalimar's, the place where Duke Ellington used to get his hair cut. A barber greeted me and introduced himself as Streamline. "How may I help you today, miss?" he asked. "I would like to have my hair cut," I said, "and I want it as short as you can possibly get it." The man stared at me as if I had a unibrow. "Excuse me? What do you want?" "You see my hair," I said, pointing at it. "I want it cut. And then I would like to have it shampooed so that it goes back to its natural state." He coughed.
"Are you sure that's what you want?"
"I'm sure," I said. He put me in his chair and draped a cape around me. He then turned on his clippers. As he proceeded to cut, I closed my eyes, mostly because I didn't want the sight of my neck-length hair to deter me from my mission. He cut for 15 minutes or so before saying, "Well, how do you like it?" I flung open my lids. "It's not short enough," I told him. My hair then was probably 8 inches, and he'd cut it down to about 5. "I want it as close to my scalp as you can get it," I told him.
"Okay, miss," he muttered. "Whatever you want."
I closed my eyes again and let him buzz away. Even once he turned off the clippers and said, "Okay, let's go to the shampoo bowl." I kept my eyes closed as he led me to it. He shampooed me once, twice, and a third time. He then took me back to his chair, blow-dried my hair, rubbed some pomade through it, and patted it down. "What do you think?" he said.
When I opened my eyes and saw myself in the mirror, I said, "That's her." My half-inch fro looked exactly to me like the one my character would have worn. The next morning for the show, I strode onto the set with my head tied in a kerchief. I got my makeup done, my costume on, and heard the director yell, "Places, please!" Just as I walked onto the stage, I pulled off my scarf. The room stopped. By the dumbfounded look on the director's face, I was sure I was about to be fired. "Cicely," he said, walking slowly toward me, "you've cut your hair." I nodded. "You know," he said, drawing in a breath, "I wanted to ask you to do that, but I didn't have the nerve." My character is who gave me the audacity. Anytime I've changed my hair over the years of my career, it has had nothing to do with me personally. It has always been about being authentically in character, about staying as true to her essence and appearance as I can. That has always been my sole intention. And yet when that episode aired, all anyone could talk about was this actress who showed up on television with a nappy head. That was only the beginning. The next year, the actor George C. Scott saw me in The Blacks. He asked my agent to send me over to audition for East Side, West Side, the CBS drama series he starred in. I'd heard they wanted Diana Sands for the part, but my agent insisted they had always had me in mind. So soon after, I read for the role of Jane Foster, a secretary to an unflinching New York City caseworker, Scott. As I left the audition, I asked the casting director, "What should I do with my hair?" Again, I wanted to ensure my hairstyle would reflect the character. "Leave it the way it is," he said matter-of-factly. I played on the series for one season and was the first Black woman to star in a television drama. I also was the first Black TV actress to reveal my hair in its bare-naked state. Within weeks of my first appearance, letters began pouring in. All over the country, hairdressers wrote to the network claiming I was impacting their business. "My clients want to have their hair cut off like the Black girl on your show," they wrote. Episode after episode, the letters continued arriving by the bushels. I now wish I'd had the sense to save some of them, just so I could read them again and laugh as I remember. "This actress has all our customers chopping off their hair," the salon owners noted. In that sense, their business was thriving. Never had there been such demand for female barbers, some said. But their earnings for chemical services? Gone, or at least noticeably curtailed. That is how the natural hair trend of the 1960s began. I loved wearing my hair natural. I felt beautiful with it, like the real me, which is why I continued with the style long after East Side. It was also incredibly freeing, since for the first time in my life, I could wash and go, minus any scalp abrasions from chemicals. Maya, of course, loved my new look. "We always wore our hair natural on the road," she said, recalling earlier days when she traveled abroad with the touring company of Porgy and Bess. Overseas, no one was mixing lye or heating hot combs, so you had to wear it the way God gave it to you. The first time my daughter saw me with my fro, she gasped. She then called my mother and told her I'd cut off my hair. "What do you mean she cut off her hair?" my mom breathed into the receiver. "She wouldn't be so damn foolish." She was something else, that Frederica, and certainly never one to clamp her tongue when it came to her children's choices. For a while, she wouldn't even let me come to her apartment. "You're not going to embarrass me in front of my neighbors," she said. God help that woman. While I was on East Side, a Black organization in D.C. flew me in for a big award, to recognize me as a pioneer in the emerging trend toward natural hair. When the splendorous celebration was over, the leaders got down to the root of what they actually felt. They whisked me into a side room and told me how I was degrading black women by wearing my natural hair on stage for the entire country to witness. "You're in a position to glorify our beauty," one said, "and you're doing the opposite. You're wearing your hair nappy on live television." Can you imagine the hypocrisy? Ciao. I set down the award they'd given me, marched right out the door, and never glanced back. How is it degrading to walk through the world displaying the hair I was born with? It wasn't. It's still not. And yet over centuries, we've been taught to be ashamed. It did not begin that way. Our ancestors, long before they were sold from their homeland, took great pride in the appearance of their hair. Our foremothers created the world's most ornate, intricate, and diverse hairstyles, squeezing their young'uns between their thighs, swapping laughter with every braid and twist. In our communities, to be groomed was to be loved. With our mothers' hands down in our scalps, in the tenderness present in their palms, we felt cared for and connected. Hair, for us, was the opposite of disgrace. It represented intimacy. During the Middle Passage, our untended locks became matted, our rituals and unique hair tools were stolen from us. In the New Land, European traders often cut off the tresses of their cargo, their animals covered in wool, not human hair. The dehumanization did not end there. In European narratives, our hair has been presented as mangy and unmanageable, dirty and rough. The American-born English writer Florence Kate Upton was among the first to degrade our appearance with the creation in 1895 of her character, Gollywog. Then in 1899, Scottish author Helen Bannerman published The Story of Little Black Sambo, which became widely popular around the world for more than a half century. Both Gollywog and Sambo were presented as dark-skinned pickaninnies with big red lips and frizzy hair. Upton described her character as a horrid sight, the blackest gnome. The British Gollywog doll carried over into a 1944 storybook by English writer Enid Mary Blyton, who formed the trio Golly, Woggy, and Nigger. Blyton peddled her beliefs far and wide, selling more than 600 million of her various books around the globe. In the late 1800s, all the way through the 1950s, B. Liedersdorf Company sold a product called Nigger Hair Smoking Tobacco in a metal tin can bearing the picture of a black person's head with an enormous afro and nose ring. White folks have been otherizing us for hundreds of years, initially because that served their purpose in justifying our enslavement. Brutes, or those labeled as less than human, needn't be accorded respect. Just as they've policed our bodies, they've criminalized our tresses while attempting to extinguish our very existence. In minstrel shows, in books, on television, in kitchen table conversations, our natural hair has always been under siege in a calculated campaign to devalue us. In hindsight, I do not fault my mom or even the leaders at that awards banquet for decrying my natural hair. The crusade to hide our crowning glory, to consider its texture somehow inferior to that of whites, has hooked its claws into all of us in one way or another. It is as insidious as it is pervasive, like dust particles in the air. You breathe in the toxins without recognizing they're even present. Moreover, a black woman's hairstyle in this country has often been linked to her survival. In the color hierarchy set up by slave owners, the closer you were to looking white, fair skin, loose curls rather than tightly coiled ones, the higher your status in their eyes. Over centuries, we were taught to disregard ourselves, a habit we are still unlearning. How I hope that we can. And while striving to do so, I also pray we can begin defining ourselves for ourselves, dismissing the 300 years of a Eurocentric beauty standard hovering over us. As gorgeous as our locks appear, as powerfully as they express our artistic genius, as often as they've been used as a barometer of our politics, our hair is not truly who we are. We are defined not by what grows from our heads, but what flows from our hearts. That is our greatest testimony. Our hair may be our crown, yet a life of love and service is our real glory. So as we navigate our journey, let us graciously make space for one another. Whether you relax it or coil it, weave it or dread it, cover it with a wig or cut it plumb off, the choice is yours. Good hair is your hair, however you decide to wear it. The 1960s, for me, were filled with a spate of roles, some forgettable, others leaving an imprint. Most of the time, I was just happy to be working, bringing in a steady income to support Joan. In the years following her birth, I had a sense that I would not have more children, and I didn't want my one child to ever go without. After landing roles in the Blacks and East Side, West Side, my first two steady income sources, I immediately took out a life insurance policy for $500,000. By then, Joan had finished high school, and her passion for social justice had led her to become a mentor with a church-affiliated organization based in the village. For years, she both worked and lived in that community, growing close to her fellow mentors as they together supported children. Though Joan was no longer at my side daily, I still wanted to be sure she'd always be financially secure. Later on, as I started earning more, I eventually increased the insurance policy to $1 million. And if I got a per diem on a show, I would not spend it. I'd instead take my lunch to work and set aside the money for her. I was sometimes surprised at how quickly those small amounts added up. Following my Fro debut in Eastside, I had some other television firsts. In 1966, the year Miles and I began seeing one another, I got a role on Guiding Light as Martha Frazier, a registered nurse known for handing out advice to her comrades and the first Black character to appear on a soap opera. I never watched Guiding Light, even after I landed the part. That wasn't the case for my mother and sister, however. They followed every single plot twist. My mother, who by then had loosened her entertainment is evil beliefs in favor of some daily amusement, would sit on her living room couch while shouting at the TV screen, telling so-and-so how wrong he was to steal someone's wife. These conversations would go on for hours, do you hear me? And just about every time they saw me on an episode, they'd call me saying, "You shouldn't have done such and such." Miles even got in on the conversation. After work, when I'd see him, he'd meet me at the door with a smirk and his input. "Who do you think you are giving these people advice? You've got some nerve getting on television and telling people what to do and how to do it. It's none of your business." Between hours-long sessions on his horn in the basement, he somehow also found the time to tune into Guiding Light. In those years, I also played Princess Amara in I Spy, the NBC series starring Bill Cosby. That's where I first met Bill. Years later, he and I co-starred in The Bill Cosby Show, 1969 to 1971, the first of two to bear his name. I portrayed Mildred Hermosa, the blind date and first girlfriend of Bill's character Chet, and for this role, I wore a bouffant afro wig. I'll never forget the blind date scene. The sun was out, a gorgeous day. For a costume, they had me in a full-length, colorful silk dress that hit at my hips. I had to take this long walk to get over to Bill's character. When I drew close, I walked into his arms and we kissed. Right after we'd acted it out, the sound man yelled, "Cut!" He'd heard some kind of ambient noise, he told us. We did it all over, and when he heard the same thing, we did it a third time. The commotion, it turned out, was Bill's heart thumping away in his chest. In all of our years working together, he never laid a finger on me offset. But for that scene, I did get his ticker going. I got to know Bill and Camille well during that era. We all became close. Bill, jazz connoisseur that he is, worshipped the ground Miles walked on. From time to time, we'd all have dinner at their place. Bill was constantly laughing, always the comedian. You could never have a serious conversation with him, because whatever you said, he turned it into a joke. Camille was always wonderful to me, polite and kind, with impeccable manners. I remember her as innocent and fairly reserved in the early years of their marriage. Her parents hadn't initially wanted her to marry Bill. I once noticed a piece of paper posted over Bill's office door. "What is that?" I asked him. He told me it was a letter young Camille had once written to him while they were dating, explaining that she had to break off their relationship because her family did not approve. Bill, of course, went on a campaign and changed their minds, and he wanted everybody to know he'd won. The posted letter was proof of that. A few months after Miles and I got together, my third eye started blinking. My sixth sense had never gone away. Since that year in my childhood, when I'd foreseen the fire and heard whispers from my deceased aunt, I was constantly having premonitions. Much of the time, my clairvoyance showed up in the form of vivid dreams. I'd dream of someone, and then the very next hour or day, that person would either pass me on the street or show up at my door. Other times, I'd hear a voice, clear as if someone were standing in the room with me. As a child, this did not rattle me, but as I got older and the foresights came with greater frequency, they began upsetting me. With all these voices and visions, I truly started wondering whether I'd gone stark raving mad. A turning point came on an evening in 1967. I was staying at a hotel in Midtown to be near whatever show I was working on then. My cousin Don Shirley had been on my mind all week, so I decided to call him. When I picked up the phone to dial, his voice was already on the line. "Hello, sis," he said. It startled me so that I slammed down the receiver and began crying, upset that such occurrences always seemed to be happening to me. Moments later, I heard a knock on the door. I didn't answer. A key went into the lock, and in stepped a hotel housekeeper. "Get out, get out, get out," I yelled. "What do you want?" "Miss Tyson," she said, "somebody downstairs is trying to reach you. He said you hung up on him." I stared at her. "Who is it?" I said. "Mr. Don Shirley," she said. "He's in the lobby. Shall I send him up?" I told her to first put him on the phone from downstairs, and when he'd confirmed it was indeed him, I asked him to come up. By the time he arrived at my door, I was hysterical. "Cicely, what on earth is the matter with you?" he asked, laughing a little. "I think I'm losing my mind," I told him. I revealed everything. The dreams, the premonitions, the eerie experiences, like his already being on the phone when I tried to call him. My cousin, whose story was shared with the world in the movie Green Book, was not only a legendary pianist and composer. He was also a trained psychologist who'd earned his degree at the University of Chicago. He sat on the edge of the bed next to me. "Okay, listen, sis," he said. "Let me tell you something. What you have is ESP, extrasensory perception. I'd never heard the term, so I gave him a puzzled stare. I believe everybody has ESP to some extent, he continued, and a few have a more developed intuition than others. Obviously, you are very developed to be able to pick up things. Come with me and let's take a walk. Don took me by the hand, led me through the hotel lobby, and walked me over to a bookstore on the corner of 57th and 7th Avenue. He bought me several books on ESP. Read these, he said, handing me the bag. And if you have any questions, call me and I will explain it to you. I scoured every page of every book he gave me, and one paragraph at a time, I began to understand this gift, this strange ability I'd been born with. The more I learned about it, the less frightening it seemed. Reading about it helped normalize it for me. If someone had given it a name and written an entire volume about it, this clearly wasn't something I'd dreamed up. This was a known ability, and perhaps even one I could use to my benefit. A premonition I had not long after reinforced that. During the first months of my relationship with Miles, we'd grown quite close. In general, it took Miles a long time to trust others, fully let them in. But he'd opened his soul to me early on. Between Miles and me, there was never any pretense. What I saw is what I got. Miles was as true to his emotions as I was to my hair texture, and in the case of the latter, he preferred me that way, plain and natural, no wigs, no extensions, no nothing. When Miles asked me to be on the cover of his 1967 album, Sorcerer, the Columbia team layered makeup on my face. "Wipe that shit off," Miles said when he saw me. "I want you just as you are." The resulting profile image reflects me, sans foundation, exactly as he loved me. In keeping with Miles's desire for the real, he displayed the full spectrum of his emotions. I'd seen him act crazy as a loon, and I'd seen him cry like a newborn. Not long before we met, he'd lost his mother. He was also still grappling with his separation from Francis. The first time I saw him in tears was in 1966. One day when I was at his brownstone, he went out to get the mail, and when he returned, he bore an envelope and a dazed expression. Without a word, he went straight upstairs to his bedroom on one of the floors above. He stayed up there for the longest time as I sat in the living room, debating whether to go up and see about him or to let him have his privacy. I finally went up. When I cracked open the door, there he was, lying across the bed on his stomach while holding a letter, sobbing and trembling. "What's the matter?" I asked from the doorway. He did not even look up at me. So I closed the door and left him alone, figuring that whatever he was struggling with, he wanted to do so privately. A few days later, I asked him about the letter. He sat silent for a while and stared ahead. He finally told me he'd received divorce papers from Francis. "I failed," is all he said, before he cupped his head in his hands and cried once more. After that day, he never again spoke of the wound, at least not with words. In those early days of our relationship, everyone seemed to have an opinion about Miles, and especially about why I was with him. Rude, arrogant, mean, enigmatic. Those are the terms others often use to describe him, as a person and as a performer. But I came to see Miles otherwise. He was always refining himself, always pushing the boundaries of what was musically possible, never settling. I eventually found out why he turned his back to the audience while on stage. "Because I can hear the orchestra better," he told me. "When you're downstage," he explained, "the notes float directly your way." And Miles, perfectionist that he was, positioned himself to take in each measure. He cared deeply about the creation of every tone, whether it came from his own instrument or from those of his guys. Turning his back had nothing to do with disdain for his audience. Yet in the eyes of some, it made him a bad boy, a man who gloried in insulting his fans. How wrong they were. And yet, like all who walked this earth, Miles had his imperfections, one of which became abundantly clear a few months into our courtship. Miles took as much pride in his cars as he did in his dress and appearance. He drove nothing but a Ferrari or a Maserati. But back when I'd met him, when he'd been in one of his heaviest drug periods, he'd lost both his driver's license and the right to buy a car in his own name. So one afternoon, Miles, who knew I did not drive, said to me, "I want to buy you a car." "For what?" I asked. "There must be something about this face of mine that makes people think I'm stupid." "I just think we should have a car," he insisted, "and we can put it in your name." "We?" I thought. "Well, if you want a new car," I told him, "you can put it in your own name. I'm not going to be the one driving it." Somehow, over the next few weeks, he managed to get himself both a license and a car, probably through his managers. He told me it was to be delivered at some point during the following month, but he did not mention the make and model of the car, nor did he know precisely when it would arrive. A few days later, I was walking around Midtown when in my mind's eye, I saw Miles in a white Ferrari, top down, speeding up 7th Avenue in Harlem. Next to him was a fair-skinned black woman with her hair blowing in the wind. I found my way over to a phone booth, fished out a dime from my pocketbook, slid it into the slot, and called Miles at his house. He answered. "Oh," I said, "so you got the car today?" Silence. Miles, not yet aware of my sixth sense, often swore to God that I'd had a detective spying on him. "Why don't you stop hiring people to follow me around?" he'd yell. Frankly, I didn't need to hire anyone. He almost always gave himself away with his reactions. That time, his silence told me I'd hit a nerve. "Did you hear me?" I said again. "I see you got your car today." "Where are you?" he asked. "I'm on 6th Avenue and 42nd, I told him. "Meet me at the house," he said. Click. When I arrived, he was sitting on the windowsill in the living room. "Come here, darling," he said, drawing me into his arms. "So, where were you today?" "I was just out and about, doing a little shopping," I said. "How did you know I got the car?" he asked me. "A friend of mine told me she saw you driving up 7th Avenue in a white Ferrari with the top down," I said. He stiffened and loosened his embrace. I hadn't even mentioned the girl I'd seen in my vision, yet his body language told me everything I needed to know. "What friend?" he said, anger in his tone. "What's her name?" His fury rattled me, which is why I made up a fake name. "Tina." "Where does Tina live?" he pressed. "I had an aunt-in-law who then had an apartment on St. Nicholas Avenue in Harlem, and in my fluster, I gave him her address." "I'm going out for a few minutes," he told me. "I'll be back." I'm sure Miles must have gone straight to Harlem. I'm also sure that if he'd turned up at my aunt's address and asked for Tina, and I never heard that he did so, no one there would have answered to that name. All I can be certain of is that he'd indeed gotten his Ferrari that day, and that he didn't return until hours later. We never discussed where he'd been, nor did I ever tell him about the woman I saw in my head. I forgot all about my vision until years later, that very woman turned up. I didn't need a vision to confirm Miles's tendencies. There was real-world evidence. He once claimed he had to drive out to Long Island for a dental appointment at 8 o'clock in the evening. What kind of dentist takes patients at this hour? I asked dubiously as he darted out his front door. He shrugged and left. It was a nice summer evening, and soon after he'd gone, I went for a walk. Miles always kept his cars parked in a garage on Riverside near his place. As I made my way down 79th Street, who did I see pulling out of that garage? Miles Davis. Next to him was a young white woman. I wish I had a photograph of the shock on that man's face. I just swiveled around and marched back to the house. He later came in, saying something or other about the woman being a friend he knew through a friend. I guess she must have needed dental work on Long Island as well. I spoke, not a word to Miles. As far as I was concerned, there was nothing to discuss. What could he have said to change what I'd witnessed with my own eyes? Not a thing. We were living together then, but I'd never given up my place on 74th. After listening to his explanations, I went back to my apartment, got in my bed, and fell asleep. When he called me a while later, I did not answer then, nor for days after. I felt deceived and hurt, most of all because he lied to me. Children lie out of fear they will be punished in some way. But adults, as I see it, have no right to lie. If you do something wrong, just fess up and say, I did it and I'm sorry, or you did it and you're not sorry. Sooner or later, the truth will come out, and the deceit, for me, can be as damaging as the offense. If he wanted to traipse around town with some white woman, so be it. I had no right to stop him. But I also didn't need to stay around and watch him do his dirt. Miles and I did not argue about the woman I caught him with, or anything else during those years. I detested arguments. I grew up in a home fraught with them, and the palpable tension they create. When my father pounded home after his nights out on the town, he and my mom went at it, forcefully enough to draw me wailing from my bed. So when I was upset at Miles, he could not drag a solitary word from my lips. That made him even more furious. He wanted to provoke an argument with me to ease his conscience. But if I'd let him draw me into his wrath, it would not have ended well. The years ahead would prove that. When I wouldn't give him the satisfaction of a response, he'd blow off steam by boxing. He had a punching bag in his backyard, and he'd be out there for hours, grunting and swinging like he was Joe Louis. And then there were the drugs. He did not use in front of me. In fact, in all my years with Miles, never once did he shoot up, snort cocaine, or even smoke a reefer in my presence. I'm sure Miles must have shot up or snorted in his bathroom, but he left no sign of it, clearing away any paraphernalia. He knew how much I despised drugs. Also, my religious upbringing ensured I had nothing to do with them. I still don't. One night after Miles had played at a club in Midtown, he and I, along with some of his band members, drove uptown toward his place. One of the guys lifted a small bag, presumably filled with drugs, and offered it to me. Miles pushed away his hand. Man, are you kidding me? He said, laughing. I can't even get Cicely to smoke a cigarette. Yet that didn't stop him from getting his fixes privately. On many other evenings when we were on our way home, he'd pull up and park at a building near 82nd and Amsterdam, then a known dope house. I'll be out in a few, he'd say. I might have been naive about